Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yahoo Finance presents It's a Jungle Out There, the podcast where we take a wild approach to work and management.
Chattering meerkats, they're endearing creatures. But they're also incredibly innovative members of the animal kingdom when it comes to social structure. So while one group is digging tunnels, two will stand guard, and a few others will be off foraging for food. That diversity of roles between males, females, old and young, is what helps them survive. So what can we learn from meerkats about diversity in the workplace? What are the benefits? And how do we hire to ensure diversity? Hello and welcome to this week's episode. Joining me today is David Cruikshank, who's the global chairman of Deloitte and who is also the co-chair of the World Economic Forum's Partnering Against Corruption Initiative and a board member of the Social Progress Imperative. Hi, David.
Good morning, Liana, and it's great to be here.
And Suki Sandhu, who's the CEO and founder of a membership organisation championing diversity and inclusion in business called Involve, and is also the CEO of boutique executive search firm Orderless. Hey, good to meet you.
Hi, morning. Nice to see you. Well,
thanks for joining this week. We've got a really meaty topic that we need to unpack. And so this week we're talking about meerkats and workplace culture. So apart from being adorable, meerkats are one of the few mammals that take on different roles depending on the situation. And it also makes that individual gang incredibly versatile in the wild. So basically, the more diverse they are, the greater they succeed. So first up, what do we understand as workplace culture?
Culture is how people feel at work and whether they feel they belong, they can contribute, they can associate. It's set really from the values and the purpose of an organisation. It's got to be led from the top of an organisation, but everybody's got to feel it throughout the organisation. Everybody needs to walk and talk the same language to make sure that the culture's right. So I think those are the main headlines. It's a very intangible thing. You know when it's right, and you also feel it when you go into an organisation, you know something's not right as well.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo those comments, and it's definitely, from my perspective, about behaviours. And I agree that it comes from the top. So the people at the top of an organisation, be it the chairman, the CEO, the C-suite or the boardroom, are effectively the culture carriers in an organisation. So the way that they behave, the way they present their values is an embodiment of the organisation. It should trickle down to everyone else in the organisation. But culture is also everyone's responsibility. It can't just be sat with the chairman. Everyone has to participate. Everyone has to be involved in the way that the culture should be presented. Because sometimes there can be a disconnect between the values that might be written on the wall in a business and actually the behaviours you're actually experiencing and seeing happen in an organisation. And that's when there's a disconnect between the audio and the visual. So that needs to be rectified.
Yeah, so when it comes to that workplace culture, I mean, one of the things that thankfully has growing in prominence of how important diversity and inclusion is within that.
Yeah.
So when it comes to greater diversity inclusion in a business, it's not just about for the social good, but, you know, maybe we can like unpack some of the ways in which it's also good for business. It's not just social good, like it actually improves company performance.
I just probably the three points there, Liana. I think that firstly, no organization has a monopoly of top talent. And I think you'll hear so many people say they want to recruit and retain the best people. And to do that, you have to be attractive to people from all spectrums of life. In our sort of business, a people business, We also have to match the values of our clients. And unless we have the same sort of value set as many of our clients, you know, we're not valuable to them. So for a simple situation, we turn up with an all-male group and we're faced with an all-female group client, then that doesn't go down very well. So I think that's the second point I'd make. The third point is more general purpose and values. And I think, you know, an organization that has a great value set, great purpose, is more sustainable for the long term. And I think there's so much research and evidence on that. So those are the three things I'd say.
I think I don't think anyone could argue that diversity and inclusion isn't good for business anymore, because there is so much research out there now that demonstrates that companies will be more profitable if they are more diverse and inclusive, full stop. So, I mean, we did some research with the Center for Economics and Research earlier this year, where we demonstrated that companies that had more diversity and more diverse policies were something like 15 percentage points more likely to outperform their competitors. There are statistics like if people are able to be themselves from an LGBT perspective in terms of coming out the closet and being openly LGBT, they are 32% more productive. So there's all these statistics out there that, if I'm honest, have been used to engage people at the top who tend to come from a similar demographic, i.e. the older straight white male, to encourage them and engage them. Because actually the argument about it being the right thing to do hasn't necessarily always been enough to engage them on the subject. They talk in numbers, they talk in data. They want to know how they can improve the bottom line for shareholders, for instance. So I think the issue I have with diversity is that there is so much research now that a chairman or CEO can't really ignore it anymore. They have to be listening. And if they, I think Lord Mervyn Davies was quoted saying, if they're not taking diversity seriously, they're sleeping at the wheel. Because the world is moving on, we're more global, we are more diverse, we're trying to get more talent to the top who are diverse as well. So they have to take it seriously to have competitive advantage. So it's almost reminding them. My mission is also to remind people that it's just the right thing to do. Because I think we're kind of a little bit fatigued with research. And sometimes you might get people eye rolling when the diversity and inclusion comes up. But actually, remember, fundamentally, it's about doing the right thing. It's about supporting your workforce. It's about helping make sure that they belong. Because if your people are happy, they're going to treat your customers and clients really well. They're going to do a better job. So I think that's why it's really important.
So one of the things that I'd be really interested to hear, David, is that being chairman of a company that has hundreds of thousands of workers, how do you, as a company like Deloitte, how do you foster that change? Because when you've got so many people across so many countries, how do you make sure that you get this pipeline of diverse talent in? And also how is that managed when there's so many moving parts and you want to make a big change within the company?
There's no single action or no silver bullet, really. You have to deal with things at multiple levels. I think the tone from the top and leadership is so important, because I notice it in our organization that where we've had great leadership in a country, we've advanced the diversity agenda more and significantly more than in countries where it's been supported, but not with the same passion. So I think the leadership and tone from the top is so important. I think there are then other things you can do in terms of recruitment and making sure that you recruit from a diverse set of people and you don't just recruit people who look like and sound like you. And, you know, at Deloitte, for example, we do contextualized recruiting now in the UK, and we go out of our way to attract people from a wider social background than has historically been the case by having a school leaver program as opposed to a university program. And that's given us a wonderful new set of talent that we didn't have before. I think that then you need to sort of manage it as you go through with, you know, yes, numbers and statistics that we were talking about earlier, which people, I agree, some people get a bit jaded by those. But I think you do need to monitor and look at forecasts and look at goals and make sure that that you're achieving those. I think there are a couple of other, I suppose, more how it feels in the organization type of things. We've in the vast majority of our countries now, we have network groups for different minority groups to improve that sense of belonging. I think those have worked really well. Some were dubious about that when we set them up, but they have allowed us to attract people and create communities of belonging, which I think has been really positive. And then maybe a harder edge thing, we do have in all our countries diversity and inclusion training, which sounds terribly robotic in a way, but what it does is it sort of highlights the unconscious bias bit, if you like, and tries to talk to people about that in a way that's not aggressive, but makes people, I suppose, watch out for their own behaviours.
So employee resource groups, what's your response to the straight white males who probably want to know where their resource group is?
What you're trying to do with, I call them networks, you know, you call them resource groups, I think you're trying to create a level playing field, and that's the way I look at all of our diversity and inclusion initiatives. You're trying to make sure that everybody feels they can belong, they can thrive at work, they can do really well, that work will get the best out of them, and they can contribute the best to work. So white males are still in the majority in the leadership teams of many organizations. I'd say still most organizations. So they have their level playing field already. So I don't think they need special representation. But we did have that when we introduced our network groups, which was probably around most countries around mid 2000s. But you know, the white males have their networks. So creating a level playing field is my answer to everything, because I think it is. It's trying to make sure that everybody feels they can thrive and prosper at work.
And let's not forget that straight white men have had their own group for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's called the old school boys club. So, you know, I don't feel too sorry for them, if I'm honest. So it's about leveling the playing field, giving diverse communities a chance to giving them a little bit more competition. So they're not so automatically getting that promotion or getting that top job, because actually they've got a woman who's competing with them, an ethnic minority, and someone who might be LGBT. So, but the important thing with the networks is to ensure that you are like including the majority in the conversation as well. So they have to be included. Otherwise you do have the issue of that Google memo from that straight white guy that got fired for his comments. But his voice is important too. He needs to be listened to, and we need to try and build bridges. One question I had, David, so when you talk about the training, is it mandatory or is it voluntary when it comes to diversity and inclusion in Deloitte?
The unconscious bias training is mandatory.
Great.
And people get checked in the same way that we have compliance and regulatory training that people have to do. Everybody has to do it and sign off, otherwise they get chased up, because otherwise it's a bit self-selecting, isn't it?
Exactly, you might find that all the diverse communities go to this training, but then the ones that you're trying to engage are like the straight white guys who need to be more engaged on the subject.
Absolutely.
So, and also going through unconscious bias training isn't the end of the debate, because obviously I think some people go through the training and think, all right, I'm not biased anymore, which obviously isn't true because everyone is biased, including me, Mr. Inclusion, as I've been called before, where I know that I'm unconsciously biased towards diversity, for instance. So I know that in Audelis, where we're recruiting a mandate for a CEO, for instance, I'm probably going to give the straight white guy a tougher time in the interview because I want the black woman to get the job. So to mitigate that, what I would do is I would interview with someone alongside me. So we're doing it in pairs so that we get two perspectives on the candidate, and being aware to take it easier on the non-diverse candidate to give them a fair chance, because we're about leveling the playing field for people. But in fact, when you talk about networks and employee resource groups, Deloitte are actually members of Involve. So we're really proud to have you guys as members, where we then work with the women, people of colour and LGBT people within the business, effectively trying to equip them with the tools and knowledge that they need to try and help climb the career ladder so that they have that sense of belonging. So it's really important, because there are so many things that you can do as an organisation to try and foster that change you're talking about. It isn't one size fits all. And it's not going to be just one thing that will fix everything. There are so many different layers to the solution that you have to do a number of different things to drive it. So one thing in terms of hiring diverse talent is great, so bringing in diversity, but if they don't feel like they belong when they get there, so you're not doing the inclusion side, they're just going to leave. So what's the point? If you're investing all that money into hiring talent, you need to work on the culture side as well. I mean, I've got other examples of what companies are doing, if that's helpful, in terms of particular interventions.
Absolutely. And I think that we'll pick up on that exact point after this break.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So one of the things that I really want to get to before we start getting into more examples of what companies can do or best practice to foster better diversity inclusion is picking up on what you're talking about on unconscious bias and actually how that fits into what we consider a culture fit. So I've worked at places where like there's been previously they pride themselves in culture, they say they're inclusive and diverse, things like that. However, when people seem to have been let go or move on, they go, they're just not the right fit. But all the talk about someone not being a culture fit just seems to be a shorthand way of keeping everyone looking the same and being the same. And it's a bit of a weird one. So, I mean, how do you, you know, unpack the idea of what culture fit means?
I mean, my perspective on that actually is when trying to get someone to fit a mold is almost the opposite of inclusion, because the whole point of inclusion is that you're able to bring your whole self to work and be authentic. So there shouldn't almost be a cookie cutter approach to the personality traits you might expect in someone to be successful in a business. So, I mean, there are many reasons why someone might leave an organization. And if it's come down to cultural fit, actually maybe it's because they maybe come from a big corporate environment, they're joining a smaller business that's more dynamic, lacks processes, ambiguity, and they literally cannot survive and thrive and be successful in that environment. And it does happen. That's not to do with diversity, that's to do with the fact that the environment wasn't right for them. I kind of think with the mold of a person has to evolve. We have to move forward with allowing us to be ourselves when we come into the office.
Definitely. And so when it comes to, when we were talking about before, making sure that the environment, the culture that a company creates is, it's not just about getting people through the door, it's about retaining people and creating that environment. So in terms of that, how do you see, you know, key steps in making sure that environment is created and therefore retain all these people?
Yeah, I think as we were talking about earlier, I think it does take a lot of time to recruit somebody. It takes a lot of time to train somebody. And we know the benefits of having a diverse workforce generally. And so there is a lot of value associated with retaining people. And, you know, just to state the obvious, that's really important. There is something about this sense of belonging, seeing people like you progress in an organization. So to unpick that into details, you know, don't have platforms, people on platforms speaking about things unless it's a diverse group. Make sure they aren't all white males. Make sure you've got a diversity on a platform. Make sure that when you are looking at your promotion pipeline that you have diversity there, and call it out if you don't. make sure that when you are looking at people for roles within the firm, that you insist on a diverse slate and you're not prepared to look at an undiverse slate. So there's lots of, I suppose I'd call them probably more tactical things that you can do, but you've got to set that tone. And it doesn't, I think in any organisation, you've just got to keep working at it. I don't think things happen automatically because, you know, as we were talking about earlier, I think most big organisations in the world are still led by men.
Yeah, I think on top of all the ideas that David's just mentioned, I mean, there's things around when it comes to retention. It's about providing the talent with the support they need to thrive in the role that they're in. So you can look at things like a mentoring program, a sponsorship program. That could also be internal, it could be external. So in Involve, we have a cross-company mentoring program, which is probably the biggest benefit that most of the members undertake when joining our organization. So that means we're matching a diverse future leader in the organization with a mentor who's more senior from a different industry in a different company, which is incredibly powerful if you think about those confidential conversations for that individual to talk about their career and their issues that they're having is very different and contextualized if it's someone internally, because they'll have more honest conversations about their issues. And we've got great anecdotes from people that have been on the program where a lawyer was on from a Magic Circle law firm was talking about how she's tried to get a secondment to a different part of the organization for some training for a few years and hasn't been able to. And then since having a mentor through the Involve mentoring program, that mentor was able to coach her, make sure she's asking the right questions, how she positions her application. And she managed to get a secondment in that 12-month program, which, wow, you see the level of confidence that this individual gets from having it. It's hugely powerful. But things like even setting up employee resource groups. So having, when you're a huge organization like Deloitte, they've got women's networks, LGBT, ethnicity. These are really, really important for creating that safe environment where people can talk about the issues amongst themselves. But we have to also remember that we have to engage allies. So when you're talking about women, men have to be involved in the conversation because they're the majority. When you're talking about LGBT, we need straight people in the room. They're the majority. LGBT is roughly around, well, people say 6% of the world. I like to say 10%. But that means 90% are straight. So we need to get the majority involved. And when it comes to ethnicity, which is probably the most challenging of subjects to talk about here in the UK or in the US, we need white people in the subject and in the conversation because they're the ones that are in the majority of roles in terms of driving the agenda forward. I know that, for instance, and sorry to talk about one of your competitors, but PwC, I know, have banned all male shortlists, for instance. To try and help drive gender diversity. ITN and the BBC have banned all white shortlists because they have a challenge with ethnicity. So trying to ensure that they're leveling the playing field to bring in more diverse talent to the business. It's little interventions like that that are really important that in aggregate will hopefully bring in more change.
I think what's really interesting as well is the side of talking about how to get those short lists or people through the door, like having that list of a diverse range of candidates. But what I'd really love to hear about is also how do you go about it? Like, I know it sounds, you know, probably a bit silly, right? You know, like, how do you find a diverse range of candidates? But there's been many times when I've seen, you know, previously or you read about it, where people come up with the short list and there's no women on it or there's no ethnic diversity on there whatsoever. And they go, well, these are all the people that have applied. So, you know, that's the list that we have. So in that situation, I mean, how, like, what are the ways, especially I know that you, you know, recruit executive level, that you have to take in order to make that short list of candidates diverse?
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite militant about things like this now, because obviously in one of my day jobs, one of my hats is to encourage chairmen and CEOs to think differently about who they're hiring and how they're hiring. So a lot of the time we'll get the chief HR officer of the organization tapping us on the shoulder saying, hey, Suki, can you please come and spend some time with our leaders? We want to talk about how we can do things differently. So when it comes to hiring specifically, there is a war for diverse talent out there in the world, full stop. So when you hear things like in tech, there are only 15% women in tech. And so a lot of companies might hide behind that statistic and say, well, this is why we only have like 5% representation in the executive committee for women in the leadership team. our perspective is to flip that argument on the head and say, hang on, if there's 15% women in tech, how are you getting that 15% of women to come and work for you? What is it about your employer brand that's going to attract them? And this is where culture and inclusion comes, because actually a lot of these women want to go to an environment where they're going to be included and they can belong and they can live their lives outside of work as well as inside of work. So that some of the practical things you can do is when you're trying to identify a certain need that you need to hire, how do you widen that brief as much as possible so you can bring a wider talent pool to the table? So does it have to come from the industry that you're recruiting in? Are there transferable skills from another discipline of skills that can do the role? Can we look at the level below if you're hiring an exec role? Does it have to be someone that's an established CFO in banking, for instance, already? Can you look at someone who's a level below? Because everyone knows that that pyramid of talent, as you climb an organization, it gets less and less diverse. So what we call is the marzipan layer, which is probably CEO minus two or three. There's a lot of really great talent out there that is diverse, and there's more diversity there. And if you think about the focus on diversity and inclusion in businesses, where they're investing in their diverse talent through leadership development, talent management programs, mentoring, whatever it might be, it means they're almost ready for that next step. It means as an organization, you have to work twice as hard to identify who that talent is, and also to ensure that you're finding talent. Because we have to also remember, it should always be about the best person for the job. Because there are also some terrible diverse candidates out there. And likewise, there are some mediocre straight white guys. So it should be about the best person for the job. Because the last thing you want is a tokenistic approach to recruitment, because that doesn't help anyone. It doesn't help the person that's in the job. It doesn't help the person that's interviewing, because it's just a really horrible experience for everyone, and actually probably detrimental to the diversity journey.
And I think, Liana, if you go back, you know, we've heard the story before, oh, it's too hard, and there are only white men around for roles, and that's ignoring sexual orientation and other things. But the if you go back to 2011... where I was a founder chair of the 30% Club, and we had, I think at that stage, it was about 11% of directors in the FTSE 100 were women, and we targeted 30%. And I think Lord Mervyn Davis at the time, in the official government stats, was targeting 25%. We said 30% because we thought there's something about having a quorum of a group in any group, so it's no good to being diverse if you've got one token diverse person, if you like. So we picked 30%. But if you look at that, that target 30% was reached a couple of months ago. Now, has everything got fixed in the corporate world? Is the pipeline fixed? Do we have all the talent coming through from every woman? No, we don't. But what many people said was an impossible target in 2011 has been achieved. And I think that's the case in every other area of diversity. Now, people will say there are impossible targets out there and we can't do it. But guess what? I think if you set the tone in the organization and you say to people, look, I want to see diverse recruitment lists, I want to see diverse promotion lists, people will start to pay attention to that, and people will start to work harder. I agree with you. I think people will start to look a bit harder, do a bit more work, won't take short-term answers to things. Now, having said all that, you know, there will be times when, you know, the only person available, especially in a very specialist area, is somebody who is, you know, a white man, and that's fine. You've got to recognize that's the reality of life. But I do think if you, by a number of interventions, you can change the dialogue, and throughout the pipeline, the terms of trade change.
Now, I think it's great what the 30% Club have done so far. So Helena Morrissey is actually a really good friend, really, really big fan of hers. She's the founder of the 30% Club.
Yes. Yeah.
And the issue I have with a lot of the women's kind of diversity, and I'm trying not to say anything too controversial here, but is that the...
Well, you can.
I feel like gender is the one diverse trend that most companies are doing the most with. It's the protected characteristic that they're most comfortable with is gender. So I appreciate what you're saying about the 30% Club driving up nearly 30% of diverse appointments or representation on boards in the UK. But if you look at the executive roles on the executive side, say in the FTSE 100, so you've got the board that meet maybe 8 times a year, and it's improved. The executive committee are the ones that are actually day-to-day running the business. They're the direct reports of the CEO. That representation for women, I think, sits at around 9%. So it's shockingly low. So I think this focus on the non-exec side is great, but then what it's also done is it's reduced the talent pool of women for those C-suite roles, be it CEOs. I think Alison Britton at Whitbread was quoted a couple of years ago, she's the CEO for Whitbread, saying that where are the future female CEOs? If they're all moving into portfolio non-exec careers, then where are the future female CEOs? Because they're almost moving across too soon. And with a lot of the women's groups, there seems to be a strong focus on middle and upper class white women, unfortunately. Like, it's not fully representative of women, full stop. So there aren't enough ethnic minority women, there aren't enough LGBT women in that conversation. So that's something that needs to be addressed as well.
No, and I think, listen, I'd agree with all of that. I think the executive pipeline is the big area of focus in, you know, most organisations, and including the 30% Club, looking at that. And that's still a challenge. And I think, you know, you have to start with goals, targets, whatever you want to call it, that people think are achievable. And of course, with women, you start off with 50-50 in the population. Yeah. So in a way, you could say it's an easier target to get to. But I do think organisations are moving to the broader aspects of diversity as well, because, again, no organisation has a monopoly of the top talent, and yeah, top talent comes in all shapes and sizes. And so I do think it's changing. But just the, you know, the reality in organisations respond to a given number of things at any one time. If you have too many things, everybody just gives up and goes away.
Yeah.
And so it's a step by step, not making excuses. But I think it's just, yeah, the reality of how organisations work. So you know that.
And also agree, what gets measured gets done.
Yeah.
Mm. So gender is very clear to know whether someone's a man or a woman when you might be trying to collect that data. It's visible. Ethnicity is getting there. We've got the Parker Review, which was installed last year. So a target for FTSE 100 boards to have one ethnic minority beyond 2021, because we've been able to measure it and get that data. That, I think, data collection is really, really important. Mm. But then when you look at LGBT, it's invisible.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily know someone's LGBT just by looking at them. I mean, some would say they can tell me because I wear such fabulous clothes, but I don't mind. But I think the when you have to self-declare a protected characteristic, it's a lot harder to collect that data.
Yeah.
And it's the same with disability, for instance, or socioeconomic diversity, because you can't, some disabilities are invisible. You don't know whether they are disabled unless they declare it. Socioeconomic background, someone from a working class background, again, you don't know if they're a working class background because you have to declare it. So that's where it becomes more of a challenge.
Especially, I mean, I think what's really great is that we're getting to a wider understanding within society as well of how intersectional diversity is becoming. As we're saying before, like it's a bit more easier when initially, and it's all about stages, right, that it's about the gender balance. But then when you delve in deeper, it's more than just, you know, women, men, 50-50. Then when you look at the LGBTQ plus community, then you think about socioeconomics. And then also another part that I think is really important, and especially when you get to the leadership kind of level, whether it's middle manager and above, is about neurodiversity as well. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that I think that has been great over the last few years, is gaining more prominence.
Yeah.
I, you know, 10 years ago, I never heard anyone talk about that within a company to the extent that we do now.
Yeah, I mean, intersectionality from our perspective is the future. So with Involve, for instance, we launched the mother brand Involve that sat above Outstanding, Empower and Heroes, which are the three initiatives we have specifically for LGBT, ethnic minorities and women. So we believe the communities need to do more together to drive it. So with me, for instance, personally, I'm gay, I'm Sikh, I'm Indian, I'm working class, I'm a middle child. There are so many. I'm from Derby, which people are most horrified with when I tell them. Even the way that I say my vowels, I say up and path and grass. I don't speak like David. I don't say grass or path. I'm not as posh as people think. But so intersectionality is really important, particularly if you think about the dominant groups within certain protected characteristics. So when people talk about the LGBT movement, it's dominated largely by gay white men. So we're very conscious and involved to ensure that we're having different voices at the table. It's the one reason why we launched the Involve brand. And when it comes to intersectionality, I think empathy is really important, because you need to understand the experiences of different communities around you. So if you think about building bridges between LGBT and ethnic minorities, you've got LGBT people where they might think ethnic minorities are homophobic, and you've got ethnic minorities that think that LGBT people are racist. So then trying to build bridges across the two is really important, because we do great things in the LGBT community, even in a sense of the L, the G, the B and the T being together to try and drive change. Now, I know we're not perfect as a community and there are issues within that, but then at least we're together and we're trying to drive the change. Think about ethnic minorities. It's incredibly complex. You've got Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, Chinese, Korean. You've got black. When you break down black, you've got Jamaican, Kenyan, Ghanaian. You've got so many different strands, but they rarely do anything together. So if you think about the intersectionality of the actual ethnicities is really, really important too. So that's the way that we run our organization, is to try and encourage the community to do more together. Because I think if you think of LGBT in from a business perspective, a lot of the employee resource groups, they are very vocal and very visible, including in Deloitte. So, I mean, I went to a big LGBT conference in Seattle a few weeks ago, and Deloitte had a big contingent there, and they were loud, they were proud, it was amazing. If you think about ethnic minorities, the really perverse thing is that with ethnic minorities, they're not as visible. Even though you know they're an ethnic minority, they're a lot quieter. So I feel like the ethnic minority community can learn a lot from the LGBT movement in terms of how they can drive more change for them and for our community. But it also means we need to work together.
Yeah, and I think just going back to the, you know, the focus on women and the focus on other aspects of diversity, I think goes back to what we were talking about earlier in the conversation about the tone, the values, the purpose of an organization. I think if you have all the tonal aspects and you get the environment right and the empathy right and everything else, you are likely to get all of the diverse groups feeling that they belong and feeling they can perform and enjoy coming to work and so on. But you do need special initiatives for the different groups. I agree with that. And you know, we call them in some countries visible ethnic minorities, because, of course, in our world, we have some countries where everybody's black. We have some countries where everybody's Asian. And we have and so it's visible minorities in each country. And particularly in countries where, you know, we don't reflect the balance of society. In some cases, you know, we want to be ahead of that.
I think a big challenge also when you talk about intersectionality is that there is almost like a hierarchy of comfort of the diversity characteristics that people want to talk about in business. So gender obviously is the most prominent. It's the one area that most companies are helping in, because they're more comfortable with it. So if you think about my comment around empathy, I think the reason why a lot of the gender movement is more prevalent is because a lot of these chairmen and CEOs in charge have got daughters who are entering the workplace. And they're probably putting pressure on, there's quite a few chairmen and CEOs I've spoken to where their daughters are like pushing them to do more to help them. But then how many of those chairmen and CEOs have got an LGBT child or exposed to an LGBT person? How many of them know ethnic minorities in their private personal circles? It's that empathy that is really important. And actually, when you think about that hierarchy of comfort, I feel companies are more comfortable talking about women. It's probably, if I'm honest, next is probably sexuality or sexual orientation. The third is race. Race is probably the most uncomfortable thing that companies are uncomfortable about. And I mean, I've been in meetings with some chairmen, for instance, where I won't say who, because what I'm about to tell you, but he couldn't even say the word black. He felt really uncomfortable saying it. And I was sat with a black colleague actually in the meeting, and I was like, it's okay, she knows she's black. She's not going to be offended. Or just using the wrong language, where a lot of the time it's not coming from a place of hate. So I've had one chairman say, oh, you know, the blacks are okay here. And I've been a little bit surprised. Yeah. And it's me saying, well, okay, Mr. Chairman, this isn't some 1960s Zulu film with Michael Caine. Like, the language has evolved slightly. What you might want to say is ethnic minorities or people of colour. But when I explained that to him, he was mortified. He didn't know. No one had ever told him. So I think a lot of it, the language when it comes to race is a bit of a minefield, because actually it's always evolving. So you have to constantly educate yourself to learn and understand. We almost need a glossary of the language and how it is. So can you say people of colour? Can you say ethnic minorities? Can you say black? Can you say brown? Do you use the term BAME? Which I personally don't like, which stands for Black, Asian, and Minority Ethnic. I think it sounds like an STD. My name's Suki and I've got BAME. Like, I mean, it's ridiculous. So I think I prefer ethnic minorities. But then actually it also depends on the ethnic minority. Because I've referred to a black woman as black and she kind of equates it to the N-word. So again, I was horrified saying that is not how I meant it at all, this Nigerian black woman. So it is really, really challenging. But then we have to open the conversation, the dialogue to talk about it, to then actually stop doing some of the interventions we've talked about earlier in this conversation to help those communities.
And I think language is really important. You know, I mean, the way that communications are done in an organization, the way that things are presented, the terminology used all the time, I think it's, again, it's worth having many views on formal communications that go out to make sure that they are relevant and that they don't alienate people that they're meant to appeal to. So I think language generally really important.
Yeah, and also if you think about that hierarchy of comfort we talked about, I almost feel like someone is probably more comfortable being called sexist than say racist. Racist is probably something that no one ever wants to be called. It's almost like there's definitely more offence being taken called that. So the solution has been, I think, almost to put the head in the sand and not talk about it at all, to even open up that Pandora box of what you need to do in your business. Because actually, again, with race, you can see very quickly how racially diverse a board is or an executive leadership team just by looking at it. So there's companies where they have an all-white board. There are still some in the FTSE 350, for instance, or an all-white leadership team. So there is a real challenge to be had, particularly if you're a global consumer brand where you might sell a lot of your products in regions where they are very ethnically diverse, but then they're not seeing the representation in the team at the top.
Mm. There was one thing that I really wanted to bring up, though, is that before we go, how this dialogue is changing and who's driving that. And that's obviously the younger generation, our new workforce coming into place, the millennials. And so I know that also at the same time, Deloitte has done a lot of research on this and how younger people in the workforce are changing the dynamics in terms of what they look for in a company and how important an environment of diversity inclusion is to whether they stay. So it would be great to just get some closing ideas or from the reports that you guys have done before on that.
Yeah, thanks, Danny. Yeah, we do a millennial survey every year, which is a global survey. And just about every country in the world contributes to it. And what's interesting is, firstly, the trends around the world are the same. So whether you're in Asia, Europe, or America, what millennials want out of the workplace is broadly the same. Millennials do want to be well paid. They do want to work hard. They do want to have a workplace that challenges them, that where they can enhance their career passport and all the things you'd expect. But they are also very demanding of organizations in terms of purpose and value set and what the organization stands for. And they call out poor behaviors. And worst, they walk with their feet if they don't like it. At best, they will call it out internally and say that's not acceptable and so on. So I every time I read our millennial survey, I'm full of confidence actually about the generation coming through right around the world, because I think they are challenging some of the norms that exist in some countries. I do think they've got a great value set. I don't think it's right to say that they aren't attracted by all the things that appeal to previous generations about the world of work. They want that, but they want it and they want the workplace to stand for the right things. And most of them feel that their organizations do contribute to wider purpose, wider society, to things that are going on in their organization that have those outward looking aspects. They feel they do contribute to that, but they also feel that most organizations could do more. So I think they would like to see their leaders do more. And I think those are the leaders of the future. And I think we have to have environments that are right for them to thrive and where they feel that the organization stands for their beliefs.
Completely agree with everything David said. And I think millennials can be difficult to manage, because actually business may not necessarily have caught up with what millennials need in an environment or want. Even simple things like they don't necessarily want to wear a tie or a suit going into the office. They want to be wearing sneakers. They don't want to be working 9 to 5 regimentally. They want to be able to work more flexibly. And that's a big shift for the way corporates or businesses are run at the moment, particularly in a more globalized world. But I have to also say, given my, with my hat on from an Audellis perspective, remember we're hiring very senior people for our clients globally. Those candidates also are not just interested in the reward or compensation they're getting financially for doing a role. They want to know who they're working for. They want to know what their background is. They want to know about the culture and the values of the organization as well before deciding whether they want to move, particularly diverse candidates, because usually they've consciously made a decision where they want to work because they want to feel like they're included. So it's not just millennials. I think it's the all levels of a workforce need to be included. And if you think about intergenerational diversity as well, which we haven't touched on, the workforce is also growing older and working for longer. So we need to also think about their needs and how they can be included and building bridges between the, I hate to say, the young and inverted commas, and then the intergenerational, the slightly more mature employees. But I think it's impacting everyone. It's not just millennials.
Great. Well, thank you so much for today, Suki and David. This has been an awesome conversation, and I'm sure that all you listeners enjoyed it too. And don't forget that you can find show notes and helpful articles under the Work and Management channel on uk.finance.yahoo.com. And please rate, subscribe, and tell your friends about us. And while you're at it, download the Yahoo Finance app for unparalleled access to data and alerts on the go.
Yahoo Finance presents It's a Jungle Out There, produced by Liana Brinded and Caitlin Mercer. Recorded, edited, and mixed by Lolita Laguna. And music by Gregory Moore.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.